From 12 News, this is Newsmakers.
After 8 years, Providence will have new leadership at City Hall. On January 2nd, Brett Smiley will be sworn in as the 39th mayor of Rhode Island's capital city. But the challenges Smiley will face are far from new, including a billion-dollar pension shortfall and a public school system that has failed its students for decades. What is Smiley's vision for the capital city? This week on Newsmakers, Providence mayor-elect Brett Smiley.
Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White, alongside 12 News Politics editor Ted Nisi, Providence mayor-elect Brett Smiley. Welcome to the show, and congratulations on the win.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So what have you been up to, and what do you have left to get done?
Yeah, so the transition is well underway. We've got just under a month until the swearing-in. I announced and launched my transition team early on, was fortunate to not have a general election, so I've had the benefit of a little bit more time than some of my other new colleagues in government. The transition team itself is focused on three key priorities. First, we had a session with housing advocates. The housing crisis in Providence is a crisis, and so we focused on what are tangible steps that the city specifically, not solving all the world's problems, but what can the city do in the next 6 to 18 months to move the needle? We have are planning on an education listening session that's going to be the Saturday after the swearing in, and are already doing some of the organizing around that. And then finally, there's going to be a constituent customer satisfaction survey for Providence. What are the ways in which you interact with government? What's your level of satisfaction with that, with city services? I think it's going to be a great opportunity for us to kind of set a baseline for what do people actually care the most about,
well, be careful,
and then how do we hold
for
ourselves accountable?
Yeah, be careful what you wish for on that. Well, I want to just address a very specific thing on a question that you punted on during the campaign, and I think it's time for an answer, quite frankly. The future of the public safety leadership, Providence. Police Colonel Hugh Clements, Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Parry, will they continue under the Smiley administration, or will either of them be replaced?
So I'm not going to make any personnel announcements on Newsmakers this morning, but I will tell you that personnel is, in fact, the most important thing through the transition. The most significant use of my time has been interviewing. We are interviewing all department directors, all deputy directors, and the entire mayor's office staff. That includes the commissioner and the chief, and we'll be rolling out employment offers and announcements of city leadership in the next 2 weeks.
Okay, so you won't make the announcement here, but have you made a decision? Has Mayor-elect Brett Smiley made a decision on those two?
On those two positions yet, I have not.
Okay. You have said you've conducted interviews in those. I assume what had to happen is they had to submit a resume to you. Has Commissioner Parry submitted a resume to you for this?
Commissioner Parry has submitted his information in terms of his transition documents, but we've not yet interviewed him for the position. And similarly, Chief Clements, we've received his transition documents in terms of a department briefing, where do things stand, pending issues, all of that stuff, but we've not yet interviewed the chief either.
Okay. I remember when Gina Raimondo was elected, and of course you worked for Gina Raimondo, but I remember talking to her early on, and she mentioned the biggest surprise during her transition on all the issues she knew she would face was how often the overdose crisis came up. And this, for people, remember, this is winter of 2014 into 15, and we were aware, but I don't think people quite realized how bad this was going to get, and it was clearly a sign of something coming. I'm curious if there's been any issue like that for you. You know the city well, but has there anything that's been coming up that you said, oh, this is going to be a bigger problem for us, or we've really got to dive in on this even more than I might have expected? Anything like that that's come up in your transition meetings and discussions?
There hasn't been anything that was truly out of left field, but as we've been in these transition meetings, I've been a little surprised by the amount of, you know, we've got this once-in-a-generation amount of funding in the city from the ARPA budget, the one-time federal funds that we received post-pandemic, and there are a lot of recurring expenses that are being paid for with ARPA dollars. And I'm not passing judgment on many of those decisions because they're important needs in our community, but it is a great source of concern for me about what happens when those one-time dollars are run out, when their truly recurring expenses being paid for with one-time funding streams. And so a lot of the early work next year, as I start to craft my first budget, which is due in March, will be a path to sustainability for some of these investments.
Just to make that concrete for the people at home, is that more like, because I know you are a wonk, which I guess I suppose I am too, but is that just, you know, using the one-time revenue to just pad the revenue line and then it's covering everything? Or is it like ARPA money has been directed to specific programs that are supposed to go on, but there's no funding identified for afterwards?
It's a little bit of both. And I understand and appreciate the revenue replacement strategy, which is you don't want to be making cuts at a time when people were really hurting, which is the only alternative in many cases, but we still need a sustainable path forward. And then in the other column, it's usually in the form of people. It's personnel who are hired with one-time or term-limited funding, and those people are doing jobs that presumably will still need to be done when the money runs out.
We keep saying the acronym ARPA, just, you know, this is COVID relief money, the American Rescue Plan Act. I think the city has $124 million or received $124 million. It's been allocated largely, but not largely spent. Based on what you just said, next budget, the plan that was rolled out by Mayor Elorza to spend that money, sounds like you're going to change it.
I'm prepared to change it. I'm going to do a line-by-line review of every one of those commitments to make sure that that's sustainable and the best use of that money. Maybe a year, 18 months ago, I was talking to members of our federal delegation and asked them, I said, what's really your intent with this money? You know, you guys worked really hard. Rhode Island received more money per pupil, per capita than many places. And what they said to me was,
as Jack Reed likes to point out on the Appropriations Committee,
as well he should, and we're very grateful for it. And what they said to me was like, listen, we're never going to tell mayors what to do with the money or the governor what to do with the money, but our hope is that at the end of it, when it's all said and done, we say to ourselves, boy, Rhode Island is a different place, or Providence is a different place because of this funding. And so that's, I think, a really good lens to look at these investments of, are they truly transformative? Are we doing things that we could not have done but for this investment? Is Rhode Island and Providence a different place because of this level of investment? And that's one of the ways in which I'll be looking at the ways in which those dollars have been allocated.
Quick question. We have a lot we want to cover, but just quickly, our Steph Machado, who covers Providence, has done a lot of reporting on this, but I know there's a mix of things that have been funded, like the Roger Williams Park Visitor Center, I think it's already being built, so obviously you can't reprogram that, it's been used. But do you have any sense of how much money there will be available for you to take another look at out of that 124, I think you said, Tim? Like, how much?
I don't. I mean, there are contracts that are not yet signed. There are requests for proposals that didn't quite get out the door in time. And so it's hard to get my arms around that today, but it will be something that my team
But you think there'll be a notable amount that you can still take a look at?
I do. I hope so. I hope so, because it is. It's once in a lifetime. Well, I don't know, once in a lifetime. Once in decades amounts of money. Certainly the only amount of money of that in my tenure. That we'll see, and we really need to make sure that they're transformative investments for the city.
With Providence Public Schools, which the state took over several years ago, I'm curious, have you met with Education Commissioner Angelica Infante Green since you won?
I have.
And what did you talk about?
You know, I think it's important, and this is my nature, to be very pragmatic, to talk about kind of the things that that we still control. One of the few concrete pledges I made during the campaign was putting Providence on the path to universal pre-K. We've talked about pre-K in great detail, about what that's going to take. Facilities is a big piece of that, about where we can add high-quality pre-K classrooms. We've had a meeting around facilities themselves. The City of Providence is still responsible for our school buildings, and as we know, you and the other members of the media have covered, the state of our school buildings is not what our children deserve. And so we've talked about school buildings, and I've had a chance to meet with the governor about the upcoming teachers union negotiation, which will start in earnest in the new year.
They didn't even interview you for the endorsement, the Providence Teachers Union. What should people make about your relationship with the union right now?
I'm starting with a blank slate with the teachers union. I recognize and respect the incredibly hard job that they do. I think many of our teachers are exceptional educators. And even though they didn't endorse me, there's no baggage there. That was yesterday. Tomorrow's tomorrow. I'm the mayor now. They represent people who were doing probably the hardest and most important job in the city. And so I'm going into the relationship with an open mind and a clean slate to work productively with them for the betterment of our kids.
You just mentioned, though, quite a hot potato, which is the next teachers union contract. I mean, I don't think, Tim and I have interviewed Mayor Lorza many times. There is no topic I would say he shows more fire on than his anger at Governor McKee and company for signing, taking over the schools, but then signing what he believed was a not a transformative teachers union contract. Granted, the teachers union argues that, you know, the idea that the contract's a problem, they don't agree with that. But where do you limb? You know what, you've heard Mayor Lorza, you know what he says, you know where the governor stands too. How aggressive do you want to see Governor McKee be, since he has the schools right now, in those negotiations with the teachers union?
I do think we need some real changes to that contract. I think we need to look at a longer school day, a longer school year. I think we need more flexibility for decision-making authority at the school level, meaning principals, the ability to select their staffs and have some autonomy over spending decisions at the school. A principal knows best whether their school needs an extra math tutor or more after-school programming or a language tutor or what's best, and I'd like to see those changes and that flexibility built into the contract, and I hope that we can get it through negotiation at the bargaining table next year.
Shifting gears, the Providence Place Mall seeking another tax stabilization agreement, or a TSA. This isn't, you know, so they wouldn't pay the full property taxes. They haven't for some time now. There's a proposal to renew that TSA so the mall would pay, I believe, $4.5 million each year for the next 20 years starting in 2024. And that's a massive discount. I think the estimated tax bill that they would have paid this year is $25 million a year, and that would just likely go up, of course, over the years. So hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenues off the books if this goes forward. Where do you land on it?
So I think it's premature to decide on what the right tax structure for the mall is going forward. They need to present to me, to the city council, to the community, their vision and plan for the future of the mall. I have been frustrated because it feels like this: give us the tax deal, then we'll give you the plan. Mm-hmm. They need to give us the plan, then we'll talk about taxes. Malls around the country are reinventing themselves, are evolving to the new retail landscape. The Providence Place Mall needs to do the same. And I'm very open to those changes in use, ways in which it might not just be a pure retail environment, but we need to come up with that plan. They need to present that plan to us, and there's probably going to be some iterations where together we help decide what that future is. I'm not looking to demonize the mall. It is a major economic asset to the city. I'm looking over your shoulder at the images in the background here. I mean, it has a huge physical imprint.
That's fake.
So nobody wants to see a boarded up mall. But they need to tell us what the vision is. It is owned by a global company with malls in their portfolio around the country and around the in other countries. This isn't the only, they're figuring this out elsewhere. They need to figure it out in Providence.
The other mall people might know that they own is the Natick Mall, which is just north of here, very successful. I don't know if there's a tax structure or TSA there. Why don't we do this? We're going to take a break on the program. When we come back, we're going to talk about the future of the city of Providence and Brown University. Stay with us. You're watching Newsmakers. Welcome back to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White alongside Ted Nisi. Our guest this week is the mayor of Providence, or mayor-elect of Providence, I should say, Brett Smiley. And I do want to say during the break that your transition director corrected me that the total amount of ARPA money is $166 million. I said $124 million. All right, I want to move to Brown University. We had University President Christina Paxson on the show last week, and the first thing we talked about right out of the gate was the payment in lieu of taxes agreement the university has with the city, and that is expiring. This is a financial agreement between the city and the university because nonprofits like Brown are exempt from property taxes. And this is some of what she had to say about the future of that agreement. Take a listen.
I think we would all benefit from a less transactional model, and one where our interests are more aligned, where we're able to bring Brown's, not just our financial resources, but also our intellectual resources. We're shifting towards a view that we can be more of a catalyst for economic development in the city. We get private developers, we get other types of industry coming into the city, other types of businesses, more jobs created.
So keep in mind, my question to her was about the $32 million over 11 years that the university agreed to pay the city of Providence, and I asked her if the university should consider paying more. Her answer was we should be looking at a less transactional, as you heard right there. In other words, move away from talking about direct cash and focus on other benefits. Is she right?
She's right, and less transactional. There will still be a transaction, but she is right about that. Partially because of my past state experience, but just kind of understanding the economic landscape in Rhode Island, the institutions, the large nonprofit institutions, the colleges and the hospitals, are critical employers for our state. The challenge is every time they add a new job, every time they grow, it's a benefit to the state in the form of tax revenue and employment opportunities, but it's a burden to the city. Mm-hmm. And it's a burden to city taxpayers, and it's one more building off the tax rolls. It's one more dollar that gets shifted onto the back of city property taxpayers. And so that is the dilemma. Brown in particular, but the nonprofits in general, play an important role. She talked about this catalytic role and their ability to be a creditworthy tenant. You know, we're not Manhattan or Boston, where we have developers that build buildings on spec, which is to say they build it not knowing who's going to fill it yet. That doesn't happen in Providence. What does happen is if you have a tenant, particularly a creditworthy tenant like Brown University, that says we're willing to take 25% of the space, then the property can go forward, the project can go forward, and that helps increase and develop the tax base. And so I appreciate that they've been playing that role in the past, and I hope that they'll do more of that in the future. But there also needs to be a piece of the puzzle that is also a payment in lieu of taxes.
Should it be more than the $32 million that was struck last time?
Absolutely, it should be more. I think every resident and taxpayer in Providence should think it would be more. And by the way, I think the institutions think it should be more. But I'm going into these negotiations with a collaborative spirit. I don't think that they're a drain on the city. I think that they're an incredibly important part of our city. And we need to come up with an agreement that works for everyone, that recognizes the economic impact on the city and the services that they consume, but also thinks a little bit more broadly about what are the other ways in which they can contribute to the fiscal health and vibrancy of our city beyond just a cash payment.
Of course, it's not just Brown that you're going to be negotiating with. You're also going to be negotiating with the hospital groups. And we reported last night that during the first year of the pandemic, Lifespan raised its CEO's pay 22%. This is the Rhode Island Hospital's parent company, Lifespan, almost $4 million. Care New England that year gave its CEO a 16% pay hike. What's your reaction as you think about kind of the message that the hospitals usually have when they sit down periodically with a mayor to discuss whether they should be making payments the way Brown does?
Yeah, so as you probably know, the hospital's Lifespan right now makes no contribution to the city. And it is critically important to me that the hospitals are a part of these pilot negotiations as well. They may be separate negotiations, but it's on the same timeline. They have an impact on the city. They consume services. They take properties off the tax roll. And so they are a part of this conversation. I'm not going to get in the middle of a conversation around executive compensation. That's a decision between the board and their executive team. But to your point, the way you phrased the question, they have figured out how to bake into their financial structure what they think is fair and appropriate executive compensation. They need to also figure out how to bake into their financials what is an appropriate and fair payment to the city of Providence. And if they can find money at least for most Rhode Islanders and most Providence residents, expensive CEO pay, they can also figure out how to make a payment to the city of Providence.
You knew, just to take devil's advocate, you know what they say. They say, we're not like Brown. We are providing services, healthcare services. There are, poor residents who get things. We're not the same, and we don't have the resources to give. I remember this was a big fight with Mayor Tavares.
Right. So my answer to that is twofold. First of all, they're the state's hospitals. And so everyone who shows up in the emergency room is not a Providence resident. Second of all, under the Affordable Care Act, the old days of uncompensated care is not the way it used to be. They get direct federal subsidy for the care that they provide in the emergency room from the very small number of Rhode Islanders who aren't insured. We're one of the most insured states in the country. That's the first piece. The second piece is, just like I said, They've figured out how to build into what I think you reported that between the two of them, they lost $100 million last year. In the midst of those extraordinary losses, they've still been able to pay their senior executives. They can also, in the midst of those losses, bake into their cost structure a payment to the city for payments in lieu of taxes for the services that they consume. Because regardless of how well or poorly they do in any given year, we still send ambulances, we still police, we still plow, we still fix their infrastructure. They consume services, and they need to help compensate the city for that.
I want to briefly touch on this because it's been such a big story this week, Mayor-elect. As you were walking into this studio, a Superior Court judge granted a temporary injunction pausing the eviction of the homeless encampment outside the Rhode Island State House. Most of our viewers are going to watch this on Sunday, so this could evolve from our conversation right now. But this all started because the governor's office gave essentially what are eviction notices to the people camping out there. They did that on Wednesday, said you have 48 hours to vacate the grounds. Did you agree with that move?
These are tough decisions. The governor needs to do what he thinks is right. The solution cannot be encampments. They're not safe places for people to live, and adequate shelter and eventually actual proper housing is in fact the solution. And so offering people a shelter bed, making sure that they are provided the social services that they need in the form of a counselor, a social worker, an advocate for unhoused individuals needs to be a piece of the puzzle, but we can't accept that encampments for the unhoused in Rhode Island is the solution. The solution needs to be sheltering and housing. And so in the midst of crises like this, it's extraordinarily difficult, but it's really not in the best interest of anyone to have people living in tents through the winter in Rhode Island and in Providence.
So housing, of course, policy is much bigger than just the individuals who are currently homeless and need shelter. It's about housing up and down the income spectrum, including for those folks. When you think about it, this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue in blue states and cities. You know, do you think you need to go into the zoning code in Providence to create more ability to build higher, to build in other places? I mean, how do you think about it? Clearly, there's much more demand still to live in Providence than the amount of housing supply we have. So how do you think you're going to be the next 8 years looking at that? How do you think about changing that to try to make supply and demand match up better?
Yeah, so first of all, we need to absolutely allow for greater density. There are many places in Providence, and we have this great opportunity, which is the city's comprehensive plan, which gets reviewed once a decade, needs to be approved by January of 24, 13 months from now. There are places in Providence where you have a triple-decker that was built 100 years ago, that if that building got torn down, you could not rebuild the same building because of the zoning code. That's crazy to me. You know, we do have some single family neighborhoods in Providence, and I understand the need to maintain the kind of continuity and fabric of those neighborhoods, but places where there has always been dense multifamily housing should absolutely allow that. We need to allow for what they call accessory dwelling units or granny flats, in-law apartments, they're kind of all the same term, where we can add additional density on a one-off basis in Providence. I think zoning is the answer to that. The other important piece of this is we've got to get over some of this NIMBYism, the not in my backyard approach to fighting new development in our city. We're not Manhattan. We have vacant land. We have vacant land for sale.
So many parking lots downtown.
We've got surface lots. We've got vacant land for sale. We've got blighted or abandoned properties. And we have to make it easier to develop and build more housing. You said it the right way. At every possible price point, we need market rate apartment housing. We need what's called workforce housing, which is kind of like slightly subsidized housing. And then we need deeply subsidized low-income housing. We need it all. And it's not an either-or situation. We need all of the above. And when we build one new development of market rate or one new development of workforce or some blend thereof, it's not coming at the expense of something else. And what ends up happening is we get these arguments. You have advocates who say, no, this isn't affordable enough.
Yeah, they say if you're building a luxury apartment, look at the Superman building. People say that's not helping the actual housing problem because it's luxury. What do you say to that? Because that comes up a lot.
I would find that to be a compelling argument if we tore down a low-income housing development to put market rate up. But it's not. These are all additive. These are all incremental more housing. There are people moving here because they want to live here. I'm delighted by that. Providence is a fabulous city. I do want people moving here. I'm excited that people want to be in Providence. I'm excited that people from outside of Rhode Island see what I see about how special this city is. But we're not displacing people or tearing down otherwise low-income housing to build luxury condos. These are all net new units, and in many cases being built on vacant land. So we have to get past that part of the argument. We can do all of the above.
All right, we have about 60 seconds left in the show, and so this story got a lot of buzz, so I'm just going to ask you about it, and it goes back to something we talked about in the first half, which is the COVID relief money. Mm. The city is using $1.5 million in those ARPA funds to return penguins to the Roger Williams Park Zoo, and I should note that that came out of the line of the ARPA funding for revenue recovery. So I think that probably stretches the definition of revenue recovery, and I have nothing against penguins, but in 30 seconds, are you okay with that money, how that was spent?
The Roger Williams Park Zoo is the single largest tourist attraction in Rhode Island. If you take the mansions together, they outstrip it, but the zoo is the single largest tourist destination in Rhode Island. I support the zoo. I'd like to see it continue to be that great tourist destination. Whether that complies with federal rules is going to be part of our full review of the ARPA budget, but I'm not going to pick a fight
letter
with
grade
penguins
for penguins.
Today.
Providence Mayor-elect Brett Smiley, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week on Newsmakers.